Hi, everybody. This is Ramble Redhead, and today is part four of the interview with Tim and Gene. We're concluding with Gene right now. As you listen to the end of part one, you realize that we talked about the AIDS quilt and the name project, and Gene had read about his friend Ricky and how his story was immortalized in a book. And again, I'll be having the book title on the website, as well as ways you can get the information and ways that you can support the NAMES project. So what I'd like to do is get back to the interview with Gene. And Gene, again, I thank you for wanting to talk some more. And I was just wondering, so then after you completed college then, you said that you did about half of college, right? You said,
I dropped out, yeah.
And then you decided to go into the military. And you went into the Navy.
I think a really good recruiter decided for me.
Okay. That's right. I remember our conversation from yesterday. You said that you had a very good recruiter who...
He'd open his desk drawer and your mother would step out with a plate of cookies and Norman Rockwell to paint your portrait. He was so good, I could never hold it against him.
Wow. Well, obviously you knew that you were gay then, and obviously, what made you decide to go ahead and, I mean, I know that, you know, he obviously was a good salesperson, but what made you really decide, you know, that was what you wanted to do even though you were gay? And you knew the government, the military probably wouldn't be the most gay-friendly.
There's no one answer. There were a couple of factors, and I'll try to be quick about them. One of them was that my intended career in the Lutheran ministry had just come crashing down around my ears when I answered a question honestly when the bishop asked me if it was true that I was gay.
Did he know?
Pardon?
Why did he suspect that you were
gay? One of the professors on my campus had heard some rumors and called the bishop and told him.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not unusual.
Yeah.
I don't know to what extent that still happens today, but the church's attitude about gay people remains in the 18th century. In any case, that left me with no plans, no career path, and I needed something to do. The Navy looked like a good option for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a reasonably good job, at least in the short term. And all my life, I have absolutely loved the Navy, even to this day. Even having had the experiences I've had while in the Navy. But I think the first book I ever owned was A History of Old Ironsides. I've read all the Hornblower books and things like that. And the thought of going into the Navy had always attracted me. In fact, I was a preliminary candidate for an ROTC scholarship when I aborted that process because I was so worried they'd find out that I was gay.
Right.
And when I enlisted, I had to fill out all the paperwork. But actually, the recruiter, I never spoke with him about this, but I pretty much came to the conclusion later on that when he found a healthy kid with a couple of years of college, no police record, no drug busts, no apparent problems, he decided, I'm going to put this boy in the Navy. Come hell or high water. And so we went through and filled out the enlistment papers, and I knew the question was there, are you or have you ever had homosexual conduct, whatever the actual text is. Anyway, he looked up at me. I was supposed to be filling this thing out in my handwriting, but he was just running through all of it and making sure that we got through it, and he didn't want to let go of me until he had me signed up. And he turns to me and says, "You like girls, don't you?" And I looked at him and I thought, "Of course I do. I like girls. My mother's a girl. My sisters are girls." I didn't tell him that I wasn't interested in dating them or sleeping with them. But he didn't ask that.
No, you just asked if you liked girls.
Yeah, I like girls.
So that was an honest answer.
Yes, it was. Was it evading the issue? Yes, it was. Do I intend to apologize for that? No way in hell.
Yeah.
And I went into the Navy, and I was in the Navy for 10 years.
So where did you go for, like, boot camp and basic?
To the country club down in Orlando. Ah, but it was no great country club.
And how long were you there?
Down in Orlando?
Yeah.
Boot camp was 12 weeks or something like that.
Now, did you have any experiences?
No. The only experience I had was raw terror, which was the same experience that every recruit has in boot camp.
Okay. So you never had any inkling or thought or anything of that nature about being with a guy at that point?
No. I spent my first 2 years in the Navy deathly terrified that anybody would find out that I was gay.
Okay. So after you got done with the, boot camp, and then you went to, like, your obviously your tech school, your training, what did you get into?
I went into the most high-tech program the Navy has, apparently, since I was qualified for it, which was why I was such a prime candidate for the recruiter, I went into the nuclear power program.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And ended up running a nuclear reactor on a submarine.
Wow.
But that means it's a 6-year enlistment because you spend your first 2 years in school.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Where was school?
I went to boot camp in Orlando, then I went to Machinist Mate A School in Great Lakes, Illinois, and then back down to Orlando for 6 months of nuclear power school plus 3 months of preschool to get you up to snuff on basic sciences and mathematics. Then after that, I trained at a prototype reactor in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, before I finally hit the fleet.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have anything happen while you were at that school then? Obviously not, then, if you said 2 years.
Not with anybody in the Navy.
Yeah, not anybody.
I was terrified. In fact, when I went back down to nuke school, when you leave boot camp, you're a seaman. You're not an apprentice or a recruit. You're a seaman. And when you finish your first tech school, which is Class A school in the Navy, you get an automatic promotion to E4. That's part of the program, part of the nuclear power program. So you have a little bit of rank on you when you get back down to Orlando to go to A school.
Right.
Of course, the place is flooded with E4s because everybody else is there for nuke school. But you have some freedom. You can leave the base and things like that. And I heard about gay bars in Orlando, and I tried to find them, and I finally found them my last night there.
You said your last day there?
Yeah, my last night there, I found a gay bar.
Wow.
Right.
So what was that like for you? You've been to, Greenwich Village and all that, but, I mean, what was that like being in Florida and you're a gay bar?
It was really neat. It was the Parliament House, which was a big to-do even back then in the mid-70s. But the emotional experience of it was like refinding my lost tribe.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I don't think I spoke to anybody. I was really shy and awkward and a lousy dancer and stuff like that. I probably just hung out in some corner and was just thrilled to be there with other gay people.
Wow. So for listeners who don't know, like maybe we have some, I do actually have some overseas listeners, believe it or not, but I was just wondering, can you explain what kind of bar the Parliament House is?
Can anybody explain what kind of bar the Parliament House is? I bet not. At that point, it had, I think, 3 different bars in it. There was a piano bar, there was a theater, there was an S&M bar back in the back, which stands for stand and model.
I don't think so, Gene.
And then there was just a plain old generic bar out by the dance floor. But it was a pretty big complex. It looked like it had been in some previous incarnation, a nice roadside motel, and then apparently it had been taken over and converted into the dream resort for gay people. I haven't been back there in a long time, but I understand it's still going strong and good for them.
Yeah. Well, to be perfectly honest with you and my listeners, I had a friend of mine who, and this goes back a few years, but what had happened was on AOL there used to be a chat room called the Ask the Gay Guy Anything, and and what it was neat about it was that they had people from all over the country that were gay, and that there was a great group of people. And what we would do is we'd actually ask questions about, you know, the gay lifestyle, and you'd get a lot of young people and they'd ask questions, and a lot of them were legit, and then obviously you'd have a lot of the idiotic bashers and things. And well, one of the things is that one of the guys that lived there or was in the room, his name was Joe, and he was a very good friend, and he had a great sense of humor. He was very, very intelligent. And, well, what he did is he and his partner, they've been together for, I believe, 10 years at the time. And what he did is he had owned a gay store that had, like, the clothing and the, you know, the knick-knacky things and the posters and the, you know, the different decals and all that stuff, kind of stuff. And he had it right next to the Parliament House.
Oh, wow.
And so what happened was my ex and I had went down there to, and we were there for, you know, for Orlando and Fort Lauderdale area. And what we did is we visited him, and then we were like, well, we had no idea what the Parliament House was. And, well, let's just say we got a little bit of an education, but, it was definitely eye-opening. And, but, you know, it did have like three or four bars, like you mentioned, but then it's also the hotel. And, well, let's just say, it's kind of like a bathhouse in a hotel. That's what it is. And it was just, kind of bizarre. And, you know,
imagine, I mean, there'll probably be some lawsuit for me saying this or something, but imagine a gay ringling circus.
Yes. That would,
bar.
Yeah, that would be good.
And, yeah.
And to be honest with you, I mean, I, you know, never been to like a bathhouse or like that before. And the thing that floored me is just, you know, walking around. The thing that was amazing is that, like you said, there was like three different bars. They had one that was like a dance bar that, you know, played the hip, you know, the dance music. And then you go to another one, it was like a country and western type thing. And then they had another one that was kind of like a, you know, like maybe more of a leather type thing. And then a lot of the other times is people just walking around and,
tea dance on Sunday afternoon in Orlando, Florida.
Yeah, and it was just amazing. There was, and I still will never forget. This is haunted in my memory forever, and I wish maybe I need electronic therapy to get rid of it. But I will never forget. I saw this guy in his hotel room. He had a door wide open. He had two double beds, and he had what I think would be called a cruise missile. on the side of the other bed, and a big jar of family-sized Vaseline. And he was wanting someone to do something with that. I have no idea what, but but I was like, ah, let's get out of here. So it was definitely an eye-opening experience, let me tell you.
You know, that's, I mean, thank God for people like that. That's what makes the rest of us look reasonable.
Yeah, I was like, and he had other little toys there, and he's just smiling, go, hi, and I'm like,
hey, boys, you want to have fun?
Yeah. Well, he wanted to have fun, and having said
that. Well, if you want to have fun, go to the Parliament House. You know, yeah. I tell you, as I said, I haven't been back there in years. Tim and I ought to take a vacation and go visit the place.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful refuge.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so full of joy and life, and it was so carefree, and the drag queens were absolutely fantastic. The shows were marvelous.
Yeah.
Even the ones that were bad, they were so bad, they were wonderful.
Yeah. Well,
and,
see, that's...
And okay, nothing but fond memories of that.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing that got me, kind of like what you said, because obviously that was your... Was that your first bar that you went to then, right?
Well, I had been to a few bars in Greenwich Village when I was in college, but after having gone into the Navy, it was sort of a... almost a terrifying experience to go into a bar because you were so worried about somebody finding out about you.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
So after you did Florida then, what was the next step for you?
That then was back up to prototype training in Connecticut, and that was where you actually worked on a reactor as a trainer, a trainee. And they even let you touch things, and they kept a close eye on you so you didn't break anything. And after that, if you made it through prototype training, and I did, you finally went to the fleet. And so I reported aboard a submarine at the submarine base in New London, Connecticut.
And how long did you do that?
I was on the USS Nathaniel Green for a few years. I don't remember exactly how many. We made a couple of patrols, and then I rode the boat for about 14 months in the shipyard during an overhaul. And that was just a wonderful experience. When I first reported aboard the ship, I was, again, terrified of anybody finding out that I was gay, so I kept everything on the QT. I had finally had a car, and I heard that there was a gay bar across the river in New London. So I set out one evening to find this gay bar, and I found it. And I pulled in, and I was getting out of my car, and I saw another car pull in the parking lot, and I was just struck dumb with fear, because it was a guy from my boat.
Oh, wow.
And I was so afraid that I ducked down behind the cars in the parking lot, snuck back to my car, slunk down in the driver's seat, and drove out of there in terror that he would see me. I was so scared. I never thought to think, well, gee, you know, he's going in a gay bar, too.
Yeah. I mean, you could have had a friend there.
Well, yeah.
Did you ever talk to him afterwards?
Yeah. Shortly after that, I made my first patrol, and it was a real eye-opener. I was new to the boat. I worked back in the engine room, you know, hard-working guys who end up dirty at the end of their watch, but it was a really close-knit group of people, an extraordinary community. That may sound like a weird thing to say about the crew of a submarine, but that's really the best way to describe it. And, excuse me, like in a lot of other male communities, there was a lot of kidding, and it had a sexual content to it. And I kept listening to all the jokes about being gay and stuff like that, and I kept listening for the tone of voice that was abusive or derogatory, and all I heard was joking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting. So anyway, when I first reported aboard, you're assigned a sea daddy. That's a senior person in the same job specialty as you, and it's their unfortunate duty to take you around, introduce you, and make sure you don't hurt yourself until you learn the ropes. So my sea daddy's taking me through the engine room and introducing me to people, and he says, oh, and you're going to meet Chief Chase. Now you just have to be prepared. And I'm asking, like, for what? But he just drives right past it. He won't say anything. He continues taking me around, introducing me to other guys. And at one point, we're standing in the engine room upper level when the deck grate behind me pops up, and somebody comes climbing up from lower level, and my sea daddy hands me a piece of paper and says, whatever you do, don't say this in front of Chief Chase. And I'm wondering, what's the big deal? I'm looking at the two words on this piece of paper and wondering, what's the big deal? Anyway, this guy comes up from lower level, comes over, and my sea daddy introduces me to Chief Chase. And I'm talking to him, introducing myself, telling him where I got my training and all of that, and I'm still holding this piece of paper in my hand, looking at these two words, and without thinking, I turn to my sea dad, and I say, how come you can't say Ricardo Montalban in front of Chief Chase?
Oh, no.
And all of a sudden, Chief Chase throws his arms up in the air, yells, Ricardo Montalban, and grabs me, dips me, and plants this great big juicy lip lock on me. And Greg, my sea daddy, he's like, that's why you don't say blank blank in front of Chief Chase.
So he did that with everybody?
Well, anybody who had the unfortunate experience of saying Ricardo Montalban, they pretty much got the same treatment, yeah.
Wow.
You could tell this was a hard-working environment where people were just going to let off steam. And it became apparent really quickly that what made a difference here was, like, are you going to get your work done, and are you just going to be cool with the gang, or what?
Well, did he? I'm just curious. Why Ricardo Montalban? Why him?
You know, I still have yet to get an explanation on that. But it doesn't really make a difference. It's part of the lore of this wonderful ship.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a hilarious story. And the ironic thing was, last night I was, for all my listeners who may or may not know, normally Sunday night is my homo movie night, and we watch a different movie. And, well, what happened was, one of the things we watched was this documentary called Color Me Lavender. And what it did is it talked about all the gay undertones in all the movies, and especially like in the 50s and 60s. And they had a clip where Ricardo Montalban, as a young man, who...
I need to grab you and dip you now.
Well, no, he didn't do that, but I'm just saying, I gotta say, as a younger man, well, he was attractive as an older man, but he was hot. But anyway, the quick change subject, but it was really amazing, because there's a part where he's like being injured, and this other guy's like giving him a body massage, and Ricardo Montalban is sitting there with no shirt on, and the guy is just making these comments about, oh, I don't have a girl, you know, and all this stuff. And the guy goes, well, why not? He says, oh, I don't know, I'm just shy. And see, a lot of the movies back then, that's the kind of character that was out there, that, oh,
yeah,
it's just a, you know, a mild-mannered guy that didn't have sex with women, but no one made the assumption that they were gay. And so that was one of the messages.
Well, yeah,
in the movie.
They did. That's why your mother didn't want you to see those kinds of movies when you were a kid. That was considered adult content.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, see, they made
sure,
the whole purpose of the documentary is that they were just talking about all the under subtle tones of the movie. Like, there was a lot of scenes with Bob Hope and Danny Kaye, and how he'd make these little campy remarks about, you know, about...
Look at some of the movies from the late 20s and early 30s before the censorship codes really took hold in Hollywood, and it's a lot more blatant than you'd ever imagine.
Yeah. Well, the thing that killed me was the very first movie that actually won, I believe, Academy Award, was the movie Wings. And and I don't know if you know this, but there's one scene, and they showed in this documentary, where the one man is like, I don't know if he's dying, and the other man is trying to comfort him, and he's running his hands through his hair, and he says, no one will understand what it's like to for you to be a true friend. And I mean, it was like, and that was the first movie.
Does that sound like code words to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was just amazing.
Yep.
And that's what.
But we just invented gay people yesterday, so nobody's had a chance to get over it yet.
And that movie was in the 20s or 30s or whatever. I mean, I don't know the year, but I mean, it was just amazing. So I just thought it was incredible. So if anybody would be interested, check out, it's like a documentary called Color Me Lavender, and it talks about all the, you know, about this very subject. So check it out. It's very, very interesting. Okay, so going back then, so you're on the ship and you... You said,
well, I have to tell you about one more introduction on the ship.
Okay.
We were in the auxiliary machinery room. My sea daddy, Greg, is introducing me to one of the electricians, and we finished talking. We're walking somewhere else, and he says, oh, by the way, you're going to meet another electrician, and he's one of those. And he holds up his hand and does the limp wrist thing. But I didn't hear it being said in a derogatory way. He was just like, oh, well, you know, he's from Boston, kind of thing. But he was indicating that, you know, at least as far as he thought, Matt was queer. So anyway, new guys get the crummy jobs, and they also they have some smart techniques on submarines. It's hard to find the door to get out, which is usually a big issue when you realize that you volunteered to serve on a ship that's going to sink. Well, every ship in the Navy can sink, but only a certain few can come back up. Well, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's like my second or third day on the boat, and I'm, you know, they're not giving me spare time to take a breath. I'm lucky if I get to go to the bathroom. They're allowing me to eat and everything, but they're keeping me really, really busy because Petty Officer Barfield is about to make his first dive. Oh. Only they haven't told him that yet. So anyway, we're doing some emergency work on the diesel, and we had to have an inspection before we left port. We're getting ready to go out and go under, and I needed some electrical connections removed on the diesel so I could continue to do the repairs I was doing. I called up to the maneuvering room, which is like the main office for the engine room, and asked them to send me down an electrician, and they did. And we were so busy, we didn't even get a chance to introduce ourselves to each other. And we're working away and working away, and then this announcement comes booming over the ship-wide announcing system, Miss Falk, contact maneuvering, Miss Falk, contact maneuvering. And this guy turns to me and says, oh, that's me, I guess I better go, I'll be right back. So, like, okay, I guess I just met the other electrician that he was talking about.
Wow.
And that was Matt Falk, who became one of my dearest friends. And he was also a superb electrician and a damn good sailor. And sadly is now remembered in his own block on the Names Memorial quilt from when he died of AIDS a few years ago.
Wow.
But we became fast friends, and also a couple other guys on the boat.
Did you eventually come out to him then?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was out to almost all the guys in the engine room and a good number of the other guys on the boat.
Really?
Yeah. It was very open. The issue wasn't, you know, are you a faggot? The issue was, are you a good submariner? Can we trust you? Are you not going to break the boat when we're 400 feet underneath the ocean? And, oh, by the way, are you fun to hang out with? That's what mattered.
Wow.
That's what mattered. Nobody cared about that. There were a number of gay people on the boat, a number of whom were out. It was never brought up in any official way. You know, if you went up to the XO and said, I'm gay, he probably would have taken some action on the subject. But it was common knowledge. All over the place. And if there were guys who had negative attitudes about it, I never heard about it.
Wow.
I never heard about it. That's why all this baloney in the early 90s about how the presence of gay people on ships is going to destroy unit cohesion and morale, that's why it strikes me as a crock of horse doo-doo.
Wow.
Because it just wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And all the people who say that it's going to destroy unit cohesion and morale, basically what they're really saying is our guys can't handle it. And that's not true. They can handle it.
Yep.
No big deal.
So then, after you got done with the submarine duty, what did you do then?
Well, I ended up taking off the sub for medical reasons because I began to lose my hearing. So I ended up in a medical holding unit in Norfolk, Virginia. While they tried for 6 months to figure out what to do with a guy who turned down a medical discharge. I mean, they just spent a lot of money training me to be a sailor, and I thought, this is stupid to just send me home. Give me another job that, you know, it won't affect my ears. So in their great wisdom, they sent me to a jet squadron. Yeah, as a paper pusher, a personnelman. And I had a great time there when I finally rotated back to shore duty after the required numbered years at sea, I ended up back down in Orlando on the staff at the boot camp.
And is that where you met
Tim?
Mr. Tim.
Yep. Yeah, we were both stationed down there in Orlando at different commands, but that's where I met Tim.
Well, why don't you tell us your side of the story of meeting your partner?
Oh, well, we both went to the Silver Hammer, not together, because we hadn't met each other yet. We went to the Silver Hammer, which was a bar in Orlando, and I met him there. Let me see if I can remember the details. That's almost a quarter of a century ago. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was leaving, and I ran into him. And I turned around and went back in because I had to use the restroom before I left. But I just figured, you know what? I need to introduce myself to this guy and see if I can get him to have a beer with me because he was a hottie.
He was a hottie?
Yeah.
So why don't you...
He was a short guy, but he was nicely built. He still got the nicest legs of anybody I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm just curious. So could you describe to our listeners what you look like and what like what you just said about him? And...
Oh, okay. 5'11" of nondescript.
You know? Nondescript.
Nondescript.
Now, what does that mean?
Nothing much.
Are you talking about him or are you talking about you?
Me.
You, okay.
I guess the 53-year-old version is a somewhat edited version of the 23-year-old version. I mean, like, I don't have a receding hairline. My face is getting bigger.
Oh.
You know? But I'm just an ordinary-looking guy. I don't think anybody ever wrote home about me.
Right.
And it for almost a quarter of a century, it has always amazed me and been my absolute joy that Tim is interested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
And he said, who do you keep saying that I look like? Who's that actor? Oh, the guy who played Major Dad. He said I look like him. I look like him.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember his name.
I can't either. I know who you're talking about. But
okay.
We'll find your, when you send your picture, we'll find the picture of the Major Dad, and we'll put it up, and we'll ask our...
Oh, in fact, we have this one picture of the two of us that we definitely have to send. It's from when we were stationed together down in Orlando, and we went to Circus World, and we got clown faces painted on.
Aww.
And then we drove around that way all day.
That would have been fun.
It was.
Okay.
It was. It was a lot of fun.
Okay, so you met Tim, and now I'm just curious, because a lot of the people don't understand, especially the younger people, who have no idea what it's like to be in a long-term relationship, and I'm just wondering, in your viewpoint, what, you know, how did you know that Tim was the one? What made you realize at the very beginning that...
I didn't.
You had no clue.
I didn't. He basically... I was coming down off a really bad relationship and a really unpleasant breakup, and I was like going to bed at night praying, please God, never let me fall in love again because it's just horrible and painful. And I guess God had more sense on the subject than I did, because he put this guy in front of me who just wouldn't go away.
Hmm.
I mean, Tim and I started dating, and we both had our own apartments on opposite sides of town. And I like a lot of, not an inordinate amount, but I like my downtime. I like some alone time. I love to curl up and read a book for hours on end.
Mm-hmm.
My idea of an exciting Friday night is a good book, a glass of milk, and a box of saltines. Wow, what a live wire he is, you know?
Yeah.
And there were even times when I would tell Tim, I don't want to go out anywhere tonight. In fact, I don't want to come over to your apartment for the evening, and I don't even want you to come over to my apartment because I just want to be by myself for a while. And he's like, that's weird. I don't believe that. So I'd go back to my apartment. I mean, we even had words on that. You know, like, what's the matter? You seeing somebody else? No. I'm going to go home and see me for a while. So anyway, I go back to my apartment, and I'm sitting there on the couch reading a book, and somebody bangs on the door, and he just won't go away. I had to let him in. I thank God that he was so persistent.
Wow.
He just wouldn't go away.
Okay, well, what I'd like to do, because it's after the 30 mark again, so
sure.
Let me just go ahead and end this one, and we'll get started right again, okay? And
okay.
We'll hold that thought. Okay, everybody, that's the part four of the interview with Tim and Jean, and, you know, as you hear, the story continues, and so we'll have a part five, and we'll hear more about how Jean and Tim, maintained their long-term relationship and what made it really click, and so we'll be right back. Thank you. And also, again, if you want to email me, you can at email at rambleredhead@gmail.com. You can also go to my website, which is rambleredhead.blogspot.com, and again, I'll be posting the information during the interview, talking about the names project, as well as a lot of different things that we talked about. I'll have them posted onto the site as well, so you can get more information. Again, you also can call my comment line. Let me know what you thought of this interview by calling me at 574-203-4263, and I'd love to hear from you and get your responses. So this will be the end of this episode. It's part four of the interview. Thank you.